Hi, this is Christy, and I'll be reading the latest issue of Vanity Fair. It's the 31st annual Hollywood issue. We start with Behind the Issue by John Ross. What more can you want from a weekend than seeing Zendaya hum along to Solange and play with her miniature schnauzer Noon? Over two sunny days in September, Vanity Fair brought a dozen thrilling actors together at Milk Studios in Los Angeles to shoot the cover for our 31st annual Hollywood issue. Noon was an adorable and very chill plus one. Photographer and director Gordon Von Steiner shot the cover, and George Cortina styled the stars, as they did so memorably last year, and used American Gigolo as an inspiration. The production involved 24 trunks, 50 boxes, 30 racks of clothing, 200 pairs of shoes, 4 security guards for the dazzling jewelry, and too many non-dairy iced lattes to count. Glenn Powell flew in from a set on only 1 hour's sleep. Said our Hollywood cover has been on his bucket list, then flew out again. Zoe Saldana confessed she'd been living out of boxes while her home underwent renovation. Lisa, the actor and singer from Blackpink, revealed her love for Pop Mart figures in one of the cheeky obsession videos you can find at VF.com, along with Q&As. Nobody's gauche enough to name a favorite star to work with, but when asked about Nicole Kidman, Cortina said simply, "She's a dream." Now, the cover story, titled Starstruck. It's the most audacious actors who power Hollywood and thrill audiences. Vanity Fair toasts 12 of the industry's brightest lights. By Rebecca Ford. Even Zendaya wins some and loses some. Years ago, she was gearing up for a movie when it imploded right before production was slated to begin. At the time, we were like, shit, she says. Then I got the script for Euphoria, and that ended up shooting in its slot, and I was like, oh my God, thank God that movie fell apart. The gritty HBO drama about a troubled drug addict helped Zendaya graduate from Disney Channel star to bold leading dramatic actor. And this year, she delivered two demanding performances in the blockbuster sequel Dune Part 2 and the sexy tennis romp Challengers. The lesson? Don't pretend to know what you can expect from Hollywood. It's not like a corporate job where you can climb a ladder, she says. This industry is weird. You're constantly having to prove that you can still do it. There's no blueprint, but there's no blueprint to life. We all are doing this for the first time. The 12 stars on our 31st annual Hollywood cover earned their place on it by taking risks, refusing to be typecast, and navigating the industry's notorious shifting sands. Some of the actors are still on the rise. Many are already beloved. We'd argue that by following their guts and having guts, they're showing studios and streamers what stardom should look like now, even as executives scramble to build a new world order. Nicole Kidman, who's been an icon for decades, won't pretend that certainty and exuberance are at an all-time high in Hollywood. Everything's hard now, she says. I mean, maybe not Deadpool, but there's nothing that's, oh my gosh, yep, this is it. Green light, let's go. Yet her own strategy hasn't changed. She picks the scripts that speak to her, and people are welcome to have their own opinions. Just a week before her latest TV guilty pleasure watch, The Perfect Couple, debuted at number one on Netflix, Kidman literally and emotionally bared all in the erotic drama Baby Girl. There was a time when a film as sexy as Baby Girl, starring a 57-year-old actress, would have been unheard of. If it's seen as a risk, I'll take these risks, she says. And if they're bold risks, then I'll take those risks. But I'm not going to hang too much on that because fear can set in. Danielle Deadwyler's strategy is to be a perpetual motion machine. I'm constantly pivoting, returning, she says. She broke through in the harrowing True Life period piece Till in 2022. Since then, she's shot movies in different genres and underscored her commitment to Frank's stories about the past with The Piano Lesson, the adaptation of August Wilson's Pulitzer-winning play. I'm trying to ride the decades, man, in a time when people don't want you to be aware of history, she says. Actors bored by the scripts or lack of scripts that come their way take matters into their own hands. Sydney Sweeney launched a production company, executive producing Anyone But You and casting Glenn Powell herself. Lisa from the K-pop sensation Blackpink built a talent management company while navigating life as both a solo music act and a nascent actor. She'll appear on The White Lotus next season. Dev Patel starred in acclaimed work like Lion and the Green Knight, then realized he wanted a little more action in his career, so he co-wrote and directed Monkey Man. A lot of people are surprised, not only that I directed something, but that I directed an action movie where I'm the action hero, he says. The process has opened his eyes. I know that I'm not a slave to what's out there anymore. In a weird way, there's this liberation. I can generate my own reality that I can exist in for the next decade. Don't tell my agents, because that's terrifying to them. Powell took the reins in his career by co-writing the screenplay for Hitman with director Richard Linklater. Thanks to that shape-shifting tour de force, along with Twisters and Anyone But You, he's become an unusually bankable actor. Old-school movie stars supposedly can't exist anymore, but Powell has kicked holes in that theory. It's the wild west of this business in terms of people reevaluating what entertainment is and how actors fit into it, he says. I try to think audience first rather than me first. What does the audience want to see? As part of blockbuster franchises, Zoe Saldana has given audiences an enormous amount of what they want. But this year, she parted ways with sci-fi to star in Jacques Audiard's audacious musical Amelia Perez. The movie let Saldana return to her roots, speaking her native Spanish and dancing like she hadn't since her days as a teen ballerina. It's the first time in a very, very long time that I feel like I held my own, she says. Giving people what they want for years allowed her to give them something they couldn't have conceived of. While Saldana ditched otherworldly costumes to reveal her true self, Bill Skarsgård found his calling by becoming creatures of the night. After playing Pennywise in the It remakes, he's been reborn as a new, but very old, vampire in Nosferatu. Skarsgård donned intense prosthetics, studied Japanese corpse dancing, Google can explain that one better than we can, and worked with an opera singer to get the deep voice right. As an actor, he wants to leave himself entirely behind. There are people that play themselves, and they're brilliant. I just don't think that I'm that charismatic or interesting. I need to transform as far away from me as possible. That sound you hear is Jonathan Bailey agreeing. I've been bored by seeing people play the same part 7 times. So with that in mind, you just want to keep it fresh, he says. As a gay man, he's had to answer many questions about his romantic life while promoting the series that launched him, Bridgerton. I was hyper-aware of the complexities and nuances of how I felt about myself being a gay man, let alone a gay actor. Suddenly finding success in playing a straight part and talking about that, he says. Since then, he's been building a varied resume with the romantic limited series Fellow Travelers, the sweeping musical Wicked, and the dinosaur-sized tentpole Jurassic World Rebirth. Josh O'Connor has been remaking himself constantly since he won an Emmy for playing a young Prince Charles, trying and failing to love Lady Diana on The Crown. His humility sometimes obscures what a significant star he's going to be, but there's no mistaking the nuance he brings to the screen. O'Connor's range is such that he filmed the first half of La Chimera playing a crumpled British tomb robber and speaking almost entirely in Italian, then transformed into a chiseled bad boy of tennis for Challengers, and then went back to finish La Chimera. I've always had a curious mind to others' skills and crafts, he says. I can't say that I'm a very good tennis player, and I definitely can't say that I'm a fluent Italian speaker, but they are two things that, for a calendar year, I was consumed with and studying. To be really, really honest with you, the other advantage is that you get free tennis lessons paid out by the production company. It's a perk of the job. Like Bailey and O'Connor, And Shuti Gatwa wasn't going to let his breakout performance on Netflix Sex Education dictate how his career would play out. He told his team that he wanted to play someone very different from Eric, whose story as a gay young man was about finding a way to integrate his faith, his Nigerian heritage, and his sexuality. Gatwa went on to play a fighter pilot in Masters of the Air and a Ken in Barbie, and assume the role of Doctor Who in the legendary irreverent sci-fi series. "I've never really listened to 'you need to change yourself for the industry,'" he says. "I don't think I ever will. Unless I'm acting really, really naughty and my agent is like, 'you know, we can't have you spilling out of clubs.' But in terms of changing who I am for the industry, that's not gonna happen." Our next article is The Art of the Deal: What It Took to Get My Movie About Donald Trump and Roy Cohn in Front of an Audience, by Gabriel Sherman. On the night of May 20th, I stood in the storied auditorium Louis Lumiere at Cannes and listened as more than 2,000 people in black tie gave an 8-minute standing ovation for the film I wrote, The Apprentice. The movie is a Frankenstein's monster origin story about Donald Trump, played by Sebastian Stan in prosthetics and a golden toupee. It follows Trump as he rises in Manhattan real estate under the tutelage of lawyer-turned-fixer Roy Cohn, played with dead-eyed menace by Jeremy Strong. One scene depicts Trump sexually assaulting his first wife, Ivana. Others showed Trump getting liposuction, undergoing scalp reduction surgery, and popping amphetamine diet pills, details reported in Harry Hurt III's 1993 Trump biography, Lost Tycoon. Trump denied the claims at the time. During the after party, with views of oligarch-owned yachts anchored in the harbor, I began getting alerts on my phone. Trump announced he planned a sue to block the movie's release. Campaign spokesperson Stephen Chung called the movie malicious defamation and election interference by Hollywood elites. I had a pit in my stomach, but also felt strangely validated. Trump's legal threat followed the first rule Cohn elucidates in the movie: attack, attack, attack. 2 days later, Trump's lawyers sent the film's director, Ali Abbasi, and me cease and desist letters that warned Hollywood companies against distributing the movie. I hoped the controversy and buzz would translate into a deal, but by the time I flew home, no Hollywood company had made an offer to release the movie in the United States. In the spring of 2017, millions of Americans were processing the reality that Trump occupied the White House. Some turned to therapy, others booze. I coped by writing a screenplay. My first journalism job was reporting on Manhattan real estate for the weekly New York Observer. So you can imagine my shock when I found myself covering Trump's first presidential campaign. Roger Stone told me Trump was winning because he followed Cohn's three rules: attack, 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 deny everything, admit nothing, and always claim victory. The insight sparked the idea to write a fictional film about Cohn molding his apprentice. Their relationship had elements of a Shakespearean drama. Desperate to outshine his provincial father, Trump sold his soul to learn Cohn's dark arts. But Trump virtually abandoned Cohn while Cohn was dying from AIDS in the mid-1980s. In the fall of 2017, my agent sold the pitch to Amy Baer, a former top studio executive who runs a small film development company. Baer believed in the idea for the same reason I did. In our hyper-polarized culture, portraying Trump as human was a radical act. We then recruited Abbasi, an acclaimed Iranian-Danish filmmaker. No major Hollywood studio or streamer wanted to finance the film. "Call me if Trump loses," one top executive said at a party after he told me how much he loved the script. But even then, studios still passed. That meant we would have to finance the movie independently. Baer would raise most of the production budget by pre-selling rights to distribute the film abroad. An equity investor would provide the rest of the money, and we would show the movie at a major festival to entice a U.S. distributor. Bear's ability to pre-sell depended on casting stars with international fan bases to play Trump and Cohn. I wasn't prepared for actors, many of whom were hashtag resistance members, to be reluctant about the movie. One turned down the role of Trump, saying he didn't want to give his humanity to the president. Stan was the exception. Eventually, we signed Emmy winner Jeremy Strong, who was looking for post-succession roles to play Cohn. Even after we found our cast, the movie died and was resurrected many times. Trump's Muslim travel ban made it virtually impossible for Abbasi to work on the movie in the United States. Then there was a global pandemic, the bursting of the Hollywood content bubble, and dual writers and actors strikes. In the spring of 2023, Abbasi was at Cannes promoting his Iranian serial killer film Holy Spider when he was contacted by a 29-year-old filmmaker and producer named Mark Rappaport. Rappaport told Abbasi to meet him on an unremarkable boat that ferried him to a 305-foot yacht. It belonged to Rappaport's father-in-law, the billionaire and Trump donor Dan Snyder, who had loaned Rappaport millions to help grow his production company, Kinematics. Why did Snyder, who donated $1 million to Trump's 2016 inauguration, allow his money to go into an R-rated film that depicts Trump as a sex predator? The answer, as best I can tell, is that Snyder didn't know what kind of Trump movie his son-in-law was making. Lawyers who have represented Snyder in the past did not return a request for comment. And why would my producers finance a dark Trump movie with money from a pro-Trump billionaire? As studios limit output, filmmakers seeking to finance adult dramas have had to look elsewhere. One enduring source of capital comes from the children or spouses of the children of the 0.1%. The problem in our case is that such people often have a Trump connection. We wrapped production in late January after a 32-day shoot. The plan was to premiere the movie at the Venice Film Festival in late August. But then our financier told Abbasi to get the movie ready to play at Cannes in May to quickly recoup. Snyder planned to host a party in Cannes on his yacht. Rappaport agreed to invest $450,000 more in the film. In late March, Abbasi delivered his rough cut to producers. That's when I became aware of a war playing out between Abbasi and Rappaport. The biggest issue was the sexual assault scene, which dramatized allegations Ivana made in a deposition during her 1990 divorce. Ivana later clarified that when she had used the word rape under oath, she didn't mean Trump assaulted her in a criminal sense, only that she felt violated. She fully recanted her sworn testimony when Trump was running for president 25 years later. Rappaport and his business partner told Abbasi the scene was too risky to portray. Making matters worse, Rappaport screened the rough cut for his father-in-law at his Caribbean vacation home. Abbasi's draft included an improvised dream sequence in which Strong wore a skin-tight frog costume and climbed into bed with Stan and caressed his face. Snyder eventually walked out. "I thought it was funny when I was on set, but this is not in the script," Rappaport told Abbasi and producers on a Zoom. Abbasi agreed the scene didn't work, but he and I refused to cut the sexual assault scene because we believed Ivana's sworn deposition. Trump has been credibly accused of sexual assault by many women over the years. He has denied all accusations. On a certain level, I felt for Rappaport, stuck on an island with his billionaire father-in-law. He had financed the movie when no one else would. In the weeks leading up to Cannes, Rappaport's lawyers sent producers cease and desist letters to stop the movie from playing the festival he had asked us to submit to in the first place. Rappaport only dropped his legal threats because the French distributor owned the movie in France. Still, there would be no yacht party. In June, Briarcliff Entertainment made an offer to release The Apprentice in theaters before the election. The small company was founded by Tom Ortenberg, a veteran executive with a track record of distributing commercially successful political films. But Rappaport wanted to hold out for a better deal, which seemed absurd because every other buyer had already passed. Rappaport was the movie's largest equity investor, which gave him power to approve domestic distribution. Would he really catch and kill his own movie? I told Strong that it was like we were living inside an episode of Succession. It would be impossible to release the movie in the U.S. before the election if the Briarcliff deal didn't close by Labor Day. I consoled myself that at least the film would be released in other countries in October, even in Vladimir Putin's Russia. That hope died when producers told me international distributors didn't have the legal right to screen the movie before it played domestically. In the end, a pair of investors, Fred Benenson and James Shani, came together to buy out Rappaport's stake. The deal closed hours before the movie was scheduled to make its American premiere at the Telluride Film Festival. As our October general release neared, I braced for a lawsuit. Talking about the movie puts him in a bad mood, a source close to the Trump campaign told me. In a social media post the weekend of release, Trump called the movie cheap and defamatory and maintained that he and Ivana had a great relationship until her death. He also called me a lowlife and talentless hack. In a screenplay, a character's lowest moment is called the dark night of the soul. It's the final test that forces the protagonist to confront his worst fears and change. My dark night of the soul lasted 4 months as the movie lingered in purgatory. I'm a natural pessimist who assumes the worst will happen so I can be pleasantly surprised if anything goes right. My therapist asks me to accept forces I can't control and imagine a world in which things work out. Making this movie helped me to finally grasp these concepts. Whether or not Trump files a lawsuit, Cohn's lessons worked in a way. The threat alone was enough to delay a deal for months. Cohn has been dead for nearly 40 years, but we're still living in his world. Our next story is McQueen's Gambit. Is Steve McQueen a Hollywood director with a thriving fine arts practice, or a thriving fine artist with an impeccable Hollywood streak? His World War II epic Blitz is another virtuoso work in a career full of them. By Nate Freeman. In May, the Dia Art Foundation hosted a 600-person lunch at its museum in the Hudson Valley hamlet of Beacon, New York. There are a number of permanent installations at the site, a sprawling former Nabisco packaging factory, Richard Serra's massive steel whorls, Donald Judd's plywood boxes, Andy Warhol's 100-plus canvas masterwork shadows. The lunch was the vernissage for newly installed exhibitions of artists inducted into the exclusive coterie. The largest new commission, which took over the 160,000-square-foot space's basement, is by Steve McQueen, the British artist and film director's first collaboration with the arts organization. Minutes before guests were to arrive, McQueen stood in the middle of his massive installation, titled Base. McQueen, 55, is one of the world's great artists working with the medium of film. His videos can be single channel, sub-10-minute miracles in black and white like Five Easy Pieces in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. His work Drumroll consists entirely of the footage caught by cameras jerry-rigged into an oil drum rolling through the streets of Midtown Manhattan. It won McQueen the Turner Prize, the highest award for a British artist. In 2023, the Serpentine Galleries put on view McQueen's Grenfell, shot from a helicopter that slowly advances on the remains of Grenfell Tower, an apartment building where a fire killed 72 people in 2017. He has participated in nearly every major contemporary art exhibition on the globe, the Quinquennial Documenta in Kassel, and Biennales in Guangzhou, Sao Paulo, Sharjah, and Johannesburg, and represented Great Britain at the Venice Biennale in 2009. In 2022, he was knighted. McQueen's fine art films are not available to watch on demand. They do not exist on the internet. They are virtually impossible to see unless they are put on view in an art context, and if the artist installs the projection himself. But McQueen is also known for his feature films, which are screened in movie theaters where you can buy sodas and popcorn, movies you can rent for a few dollars and watch on your phone right now. He's the exceedingly rare visual artist to be completely comfortable in both the rarefied air of the Tate Modern and the grind of an Oscar campaign. In 2008, his Bobby Sands biopic Hunger, starring Michael Fassbender, won the Camara d'Or for Best First Feature at Cannes. He followed in 2011 with Shame, a gritty New York City-based look at sex addiction, also starring Fassbender. 2 years later came 12 Years a Slave, about a free black man who is kidnapped and sold into slavery. McQueen became the first black filmmaker to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. He's once again in the Oscar hunt this year with Blitz, a searing family drama starring Saoirse Ronan, set in World War II London. In many ways, McQueen is in an unprecedented position. Hollywood and the art world have a fickle relationship. They're two often colliding maelstroms with distinct goals and different political systems, both with sticky inferiority complexes. And yet, with affection, both scenes claim McQueen as their own. At Dia Beacon in May, many of the art world's elite were led into the depths of the basement, where they were fully immersed in McQueen's installation, which turned out to be a departure. A series of lights overhead strobed and slowly changed color, the throbbing low end of a free jazz score physically manifesting through the room in the ripple of a frilly summer dress here or there. I mean, I really thought, and we all thought, he would be doing a film, said Donna DeSalvo, a curator at Dia who recruited McQueen. For more than an hour, the artist stood at the center of the installation, completely removed from the pomp of a luncheon attended by some of America's most powerful museum directors, nattily attired European art dealers, and NFL commissioner Roger Goodell, whose wife is on the Dia board. He stared at the work on the cement ceiling with an intense focus. "You're playing it like an orchestra, Steve," said a passing-by Beth Swafford, McQueen's movie agent at CAA, who's also a major collector of contemporary art in Los Angeles. McQueen gave a weak smile. A little while later, he tensed up as Stefania Bortolami, founder of the namesake Tribeca Gallery, came up to say hello very briefly. When lunch started upstairs, McQueen was at a table with Dia director Jessica Morgan, the actor Frances McDormand, the artist Joan Jonas and Theaster Gates, and the billionaire pharmaceutical heiress Maya Erri, who founded the Scholager Museum in Switzerland. It has the largest holding of McQueen's work in private hands. She's generally considered his great patron, and Bass will travel to the Scholager in 2025. McQueen appeared not exactly anxious, but maybe slightly bored. He wanted to return to the basement. A few weeks later, McQueen told me the initial idea for Bass had come from the musician Quincy Jones, who said something to him while they were both working on a project at the Shed in Manhattan's Hudson Yards. The electric bass changed music. That ate away at McQueen, perhaps because it came from the man who produced Thriller, perhaps because it's something McQueen already knew. It's amplifying the sonic subsound and the whole idea of the speakers and bass and this sort of visceral vibration for your body, McQueen told me. We were speaking over breakfast at the Crosby Street Hotel in Soho. It was mostly empty, and McQueen, in town for a few days, was wearing a blazer over a t-shirt. He drank cappuccinos, extra hot, no food. I asked him about the slight aversion to art world schmoozing he had seemed to exhibit upstate. "I never had that situation where I'm hanging out with artists," he said. "It's like, you know, hanging out with another butcher. You chop meat that way, I chop meat this way. My job is to make work. I'll just say I'm not interested in the fucking lifestyle." We started talking about how former factory spaces make for really great museums. 2 years earlier, I had seen McQueen's epic survey at the Pirelli Hangar Bicocca, the complex with gigantic exhibition spaces where components for locomotives and farm machinery were once manufactured on the outskirts of Milan. In 2019, McQueen had a show at the Tate Modern, a repurposed 20th century power station. "I'm from London, and London was all about converting spaces," he said. "It's always been a mixture. It's always been a conversation, a certain kind of overlapping histories, always," McQueen said, speaking in starts and stops, never exactly explaining or decoding his work, and maybe a little miraculously, tying the primordial low end he filled a room with in Bass to the legacy of wartime London portrayed in Blitz. There were a lot of bombed-out buildings which were never actually fixed or left for ruins and people's warehouse parties. The journey from visual artist to Hollywood filmmaker is historically treacherous. Warhol spent years making slapdash films at the factory, yearning to be taken seriously by moviegoers, mostly to no avail. 3 decades later, a number of Pictures Generation artists got the chance to helm proper films. Cindy Sherman made Office Killer. Robert Longo made Johnny Mnemonic. David Sal made Search and Destroy. All now essentially forgotten, even as their directors got more and more famous as artists. The most successful artist turned director prior to McQueen is certainly the painter Julian Schnabel, who launched his film career with a biopic of his late friend, the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat, and then went on to direct Before Night Falls and The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. Unlike all those predecessors, McQueen's primary artistic medium was the moving image from the start. At one point, he just started making narrative-driven films starring Hollywood actors as well. He maintains the same Amsterdam studio and workplace to create them. He lives in the city with his wife, the critic and director Bianca Stigter, and their 2 children. McQueen's films brim with the same raw qualities that make his artwork so immediate. The simplest shot or setup can be explosive, whether it's 2 naked black men exchanging flirts and taunts while wrestling, his breakthrough artwork Bare, or just the eyeball of Charlotte Rampling, quivering and blinking for nearly 6 minutes, Charlotte. His presence as a black filmmaker with no one to answer to but himself, who makes films about black men and women, such as Widows, his 2018 heist film starring Viola Davis, is, to state the obvious, a Hollywood exception. I remember when I told him what I thought the approach to the character would be. One of the things was, how should I wear my hair? Davis told me on the phone, and I remember he didn't really engage in that conversation so much. I hung up, and then he called me back 2 minutes later and said, why can't you wear your hair? I don't think people see me as the woman I am, Davis went on. I'm sexual, I'm funny, I have heart, I have empathy, people find me attractive. It's like people didn't see beyond my thick lips and thick nose and dark skin and what that represented to them, which is none of the things that are attributed to being a woman. But with Steve, I found someone who saw me fully. After speaking to collaborators who've known McQueen for years, there emerged a portrait of an uncompromising but deeply human artist making work for the screen. He's an outsider in Hollywood who operates on his own time frame and schedule. I felt like I needed a break, as Daniel Day-Lewis says. I need to let the tide go out before it could come back in again, said Ronan on the phone in September. I'd say to my agent, there's only certain people that if they called, I'd come back, and Steve is one of them. He is, his actors and crews say, very collaborative and open, but also direct in his needs and desires. He's frank and oftentimes quite funny, despite the fact that they were shooting a film about a distraught mom in an urban battlefield, Ronan said. I had such a laugh with him, and I ripped the piss out of him all the time. Lupita Nyong'o, who won an Oscar for her performance in 12 Years a Slave, called him surprisingly playful, but said that a McQueen set, or at least the one she experienced, was also a sacred place. I felt safe. I felt protected from the outside. Of course, it was a very, very vulnerable role to play, and he ensured that the set was a space that I could do that. McQueen is Hollywood atypical in his efficiency. Meetings that might take 2 hours on another project take place in 15 minutes, said Blitz producer Anita Overland. The majority of the time, he would get what he needed in that one shot, and then he would wrap for the day, Ronan said. I've never worked with a director like that before. He'd wrap like 5 hours early, and we'd all be sort of like, you couldn't quite trust it when you heard it, because that literally never happens on set. Never. A few weeks after our breakfast, McQueen reached out to say he wanted to hop on the phone again. He was back in Amsterdam, though he would return to New York in a few days to finish the installation of his show, Adia. He was in a good mood and started talking about why so many people in Manhattan walk around in gym clothes. McQueen, speaking British, called them yoga costumes, and about the very real problem of how many dogs there are defecating on the New York sidewalks. I think if I was doing the movie tomorrow and the periphery of the conversation would be dogs squatting to shit, he said, laughing, because now it's fucking croissants or whatever. It's part of the landscape. All great material, but he also wanted to further discuss his inspiration for Blitz. He initially said at the Crosby, the first germ came while researching Small Axe, his 2020 Amazon anthology series. McQueen had come across an archival photo of a boy at a railway station carrying a suitcase. Actually, though, it went further back to his tenure as a commissioned artist during the Iraq War, and actually, earlier than that, to his teens going to dance parties and art museums in those repurposed London warehouses and factories. It all came down to questions, literally existential ones, he had about his West London origins. The only reason I'm in London is because of the war, he said. My parents were asked, invited to come over to rebuild the UK after the war. So my own existence is because of what happened. You don't have to dig too deep to get a connection. McQueen's father was from Grenada, and his mother was from Trinidad. Growing up, young McQueen mostly just loved playing soccer. He's still a Tottenham supporter. His dyslexia and a lazy eye set him apart at school, as did the general racism of 70s and 80s Britain. He found early that he loved drawing, that he could always make an image when he put pen to paper. He went to various art schools and graduated from Goldsmiths in 1993 with a degree in painting. From there, he decided to pursue an MA from a film school and ended up at NYU, as New York was enjoying its reputation as a hotbed for independent filmmakers. Actually, I wanted to go to La Femmes, McQueen admitted. I wanted to go to French film school, but I couldn't speak French, so I thought, okay, you know, Spike Lee or Jim Jarmusch, Martin Scorsese, New York, like, okay, that'll be the second best bet. It didn't quite work out. He still remembers one professor asking him bluntly, "What are you doing here?" He dropped out, but not before he experienced the freedom that comes with holding a camera. When he returned to England, he was asked to participate in a group show at the Royal College of Art, curated by master's students. The work selected was Bear. Only after McQueen's father and grandmother arrived at the opening did they discover that it was a 10-minute-long black-and-white film of two naked men wrestling, and that one of the men was McQueen. The work was fierce, immediate, a gut punch in an art gallery, harder to achieve than one would think. It was something then wildly out of vogue in curatorial and academic circles, video art that didn't care a whit about semiotics. Word spread around London immediately, prompting new work to be shown in a temperature-taking survey of young artists called the British Art Show, alongside Sam Taylor Johnson, who has gone on to a different kind of Hollywood career, helming 50 Shades of Grey, Chris O'Feely, Gillian Waring, and others. By 1996, McQueen had his first museum solo show, at the age of 26 at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. McQueen had earlier met Akwi Enweser, a Nigerian editor of a journal about African art, who would go on to become one of the most important curators of the past half century, before his death in 2019. I was 24 years old at the ICA bookshop, and I remember what he was wearing completely, McQueen said. He had a denim jacket, a nice beautiful shirt, and he had a satchel across his right shoulder, like an old British school bag over the right shoulder. Thus began a conversation that led to McQueen's participation in Enweser's edition of the Johannesburg Biennale, examining the role of art in a post-apartheid world. Visiting Johannesburg led McQueen to the Tatona mine, known as Western Deep, then one of the deepest gold mining shafts in the world, burrowing nearly 2.5 miles into the ground. The resulting work, Western Deep, was chosen by Enweser for inclusion in his groundbreaking Documenta 11. That was one of the most important relationships in Steve's career, his bond, his relationship with Akwi, said Rose Lord, a managing partner at the Marion Goodman Gallery. It's extremely difficult for him that Akwi's not around anymore, and there's so many things that he feels that Akwi prepared the way for, which are now coming to fruition. They stayed close even after Enweser stepped down from his position as artistic director of House der Kunst due to ill health. In March 2019, McQueen was visiting the curator by his hospital bed in Munich, and the alien Wazer was talking about a future essay yet to be written. "I visited him a lot of times, and on the day of his death as well," McQueen said. "So we had this conversation about abstraction in the hospital. He was thinking about writing an essay for this show I was doing at the Tate. We didn't get there. I didn't want him to write it because he wasn't, you know, well enough at that time." By the late 1990s, McQueen was the hottest artist in Britain. He was nominated for the Turner Prize, going up against Tracy Emin, whose work My Bed had scandalized London and provided the Fleet Street tabloids plenty of art-forward fodder. The bookies had Emin as a 6-4 odds-on favorite, but the prize went to McQueen. "I was rather totally upset, actually," McQueen said. "As soon as that situation happens, it's like, oh, it's not fulfilling." He was pursued by the legendary gallerist Marion Goodman and traveled to New York to meet with her at the headquarters on 57th Street. At the time, her roster included Gerhard Richter, Anselm Kiefer, John Baldessari, William Kentridge, and Lawrence Weiner. "I was a bit cocky," McQueen said, "and then someone handed me the list of the artists in the elevator. And as the elevator door closed, I thought, oh my God, fuck, I didn't know nothing. Then we toured the gallery and that was it. Marion's beautiful. She saw me." In London, where he needed representation as well, he met with a young curator named Thomas Dane. And while having dinner, McQueen announced that he wanted Dane's gallery to represent him. There was one problem. Dane didn't have one. "I had nothing," Dane told me. "I had no structure to represent him. I was deeply thinking, what do I do? That's Steve. That's who Steve is. That's Steve. He made that decision because he has incredible instinctual awareness, or just antennae everywhere in a sense." "Not much more to it," McQueen said when I asked him to verify the story. "Sometimes you sense a person, and that was it. And I'm grateful that he did that, and I think he hasn't done too badly." The Turner meant something else totally new. Conversations with those who hold the purse strings in the entertainment industry. McQueen had an idea for a movie. Basically, the subject matter said it needed to be a film, he said. "I wasn't looking to make a film, but the subject matter needs to be a film." The idea of an artist of McQueen's stature switching sides, even temporarily, prompted endless discourse among the art world's high priesthood. I remember very vividly having a conversation with Dominique Gonzalez Forster, an artist who I'm very close to, when Hunger came out, Morgan said. We were all like, "Steve McQueen, our idol, is making a feature film." It was like, oh, we could do that too? But then being almost outraged that he made a Hollywood film. It was like, what? It has narrative. It has famous or potentially famous movie stars in it. It's not what we were expecting at all. Hunger is a searingly unsentimental portrait of Bobby Sands, an IRA member who died at age 27 in 1981, after a 66-day hunger strike at Mays Prison. In the mid-2000s, current Shed artistic director Alex Poots had a gig putting together performing arts programming for Nicholas Sirota at the Tate and had worked with McQueen on various projects. Poots introduced the artist to Jan Younghusband, who ran the arts-related production budgets for Channel 4, the public-owned British television concern. Younghusband managed to raise 1.1 million British pounds for what would become the movie. McQueen asked the Irish playwright Enda Walsh to co-write the script and did copious amounts of research with producers. But in terms of actually shooting the movie, McQueen had never given direction to an actor before. "The first time I was on a movie set was on my own," he told me. "I did that deliberately because I didn't want to have anyone's habits. I wanted to find out my own. The first shot I shot was when a prison officer is executed, when he goes to the old people's home and he's executed in front of his mother." He had no idea if the film would connect with audiences, if he could apply the core tenets of his art films into something that works as a full-length narrative. "I thought, okay, this could be the first film and my last film, but when it happens, I'm going out with two guns blazing, so let's do this," McQueen said. It worked. "My God, Steve is brilliant, and the way he directed me was brilliant," Fassbender said that year at Cannes. Shame, a portrait of a depraved sex addict, played again by McQueen's beautiful muse Fassbender, was shot in New York during the spring of 2011. Next came 12 Years a Slave, which even with his by-then sterling bona fides, involved a lot of studio convincing. When we made it, the conversation about slavery wasn't really topical in a way, McQueen told me. I remember very clearly going to those execs, and I remember having this conversation. I said, mate, you know what? I'll make a film about slavery. It's almost like slavery didn't happen. And then we made some noise with that, thank goodness. He followed with Widows, a high-profile collaboration with author Gillian Flynn, coming off the smash adaptation of her book Gone Girl, with a spectacular cast. Davis, Liam Neeson, Colin Farrell, Robert Duvall, Daniel Kaluuya, Cynthia Erivo, Elizabeth Debicki. Critics mostly shrugged, and it failed to connect with viewers or at least live up to the hype that preceded it. After a lukewarm opening, it did eventually make $76 million at the global box office against a $40-something million budget. When asked at the time whether he was disappointed by the returns, McQueen laughed and said, well, yes, obviously. One would want it to be better, but it is what it is. In our second conversation, McQueen spoke about his time in a combat zone during the Iraq War, commissioned by the Imperial War Museum to make an artwork based on his experience, deploying to Basra and staying for 6 days in 2003. While there, he hung out with British soldiers and talked to them about why they enlisted, why they would die for Queen and country. What was touching for me was the normal guys, the Jacks and the Geralds and the Marcuses who I was with. They were from all over the UK, McQueen said. It was one of the first times ever in my life, in fact, maybe it's the only time, I've actually felt some kind of patriotism. I was with all these people all over the country as a group, and there was a kind of camaraderie. If you had been from Newcastle or Sheffield or London or Sunderland or Liverpool or wherever you were in the country, that you were together, bonded together by this unfortunate situation. The episode sparked an inspiration to make a World War II film with a ground-eye view. I wasn't interested in Monty. I wasn't interested in Churchill. I wasn't interested in Eisenhower. When he came across that photo of a small boy by the train tracks with a suitcase, he started to build the character of George, a 9-year-old, one of the children sent en masse to the countryside as the war ravaged through a London where civilian adults were trying to go about their lives under the constant threat of air raid sirens. George's mother is Ronan's Rita. His father is a black immigrant out of the picture for reasons we later come to understand. George escapes from the train ferrying him up country and embarks on a Homeric quest to find his mom. It's a disarmingly simple plot, one that really does seem suited for McQueen in blockbuster mode. An idiosyncratic artist-director making a big-budget, big-tent, VFX-filled Hans Zimmer-scored war epic, released by Apple Studio, the movie arm of one of the world's biggest corporations. He'll always take something and slightly move the goalposts, Ronan said. That's what sets him apart from other directors. His artistry really is a part of how he tells the story. Overland, the producer, experienced that too and said, after working with McQueen on Small Axe and then Blitz, he has a way of behaving on set that runs so at odds with anyone else working in the industry. I guess it sounds a bit corny, but it's like free jazz, Overland said. In July, months before Blitz was set to be released in theaters, I settled into a private Tribeca screening room to watch the film. The opening sequence includes a bomb careening through the sky, the camera focused tight on it, as if it were Charlotte Rampling's eye or Fassbender's indelible waterfront scream in Shame. We also see London firefighters rushing on a burning building freshly bombed, struggling to get the hose on to douse the flames in water. When the water comes, the hose snaps to life with a shock. The coil bursts into the sky like a living feral creature. The firefighters try to pounce on the rampaging hose. The flames climb higher, bombs make pockmarks out of the ancient city's blocks, bricks fall to the ground like rain. It's a scene of such abstract and human intensity that it left me shaking in the empty theater. It is, in other words, great art and great movie making. Apple, which only in 2022 became the first streaming service to win a Best Picture Oscar with Coda, is banking on Academy voters thinking the same. Matthew Dentler, head of features at Apple TV Plus, appeared to be more personally invested in the picture than your typical movie studio head at a company with a $3.6 trillion market cap. He started discussing the project with McQueen a couple years ago, and through the process, they would text and call each other, bouncing off ideas. Dentler was at McQueen's opening at Marion Goodman last September in L.A. He's hoping there's time for a day trip during his next New York visit so he can make it up to Beacon to see Bays. Obviously, we're proud of the film. It's been a rewarding experience to work with him and the team on this film. But I think also what's been fun is getting to become friends with Steve, Dentler said. The first trailer for Blitz dropped the same day that Diaz Chelsea Galleries opened for the season with three McQueen artworks, and there was a party for members that night. McQueen completed Bounty, a new installation of a few dozen photos of flowers in Grenada, quickly. He had gone to the island in July. In the same gallery was something much older, Exodus, which McQueen told me was technically his first film, even if he sat on it and didn't show it until the late 90s. I had heard about the piece. Apparently it came about when, during an amble through London carrying a camera, the young McQueen spotted two West Indian men in smart bowler hats carrying potted palm fronds and followed them, losing them only when they got on a double-decker bus. Was that true? Yeah, that's basically it, McQueen said, staring at his first video playing on a loop on a 90s-era block TV. I just saw these guys and started following them around. Most of the crowd that night gravitated towards Sunshine State, which had debuted in slightly grander form 2 years earlier at the Hangar Bicocca. In Chelsea, it was a two-channel video installation projected on both sides, starting with two depictions of a smoldering sun that cuts to parallel scenes from The Jazz Singer, Hollywood's first film with synchronized sound, about a cantor's son from the Lower East Side who starts singing jazz and eventually finds Broadway fame. But when Al Jolson's character starts applying the blackface that he wears on stage, his face disappears and McQueen's voice wafts through the room. My father was called Filbert, a very Victorian name, and one of the last things he told me before he died was a story, McQueen says, the plummy disembodied voice hanging over the film. The story he tells is this. When he was a young man, Filbert McQueen traveled from Grenada to Florida on a job picking oranges, and one night after work, McQueen's father went to a bar with two other workers. When they walked in, everyone froze. The bartender told them he didn't serve black men. He didn't use that phrase. One of the orange workers hit the bartender over the head with a bottle, and they fled into the night as the patrons chased after. McQueen's father hid in a ditch, heard two gunshots, and stayed until morning, terrified, when he returned to work by himself. He never spoke to me about it before, until when he was going to pass, McQueen had told me back at the Crosby Street Hotel. In the gallery, Matthew Barney listened, mouth agape. Louise Lawler sat with gallery director Philip Kaiser, who works at Marion Goodman, and Swofford, McQueen's agent at CAA, was standing with Stigter as Joan Jonas stared deeply into the monitor. After a few loops of the film, it was time to leave for dinner. And in the next room, McQueen was surrounded by the flowers of Bounty. The night before, there was a dinner, too. The next day, he had to fly to Milan, and in 2 weeks, he'd be in London for the premiere, and in New York the next day for the film festival, and Los Angeles the day after that. Eventually, I found McQueen staring at the minute-long Exodus. I love work. I just don't love all the promotion, he said. He turned away from the monitor to look at me. As I told you, I'm not good with small talk, he said. All I have is my work, my family, a few friends you count on one hand. I'm not good with small talk. All this small talk, you just have to cut it off. And closing out this month's Vanity Fair, the Proust Questionnaire, this month featuring Hugh Grant, the star of Heretic on His Dearest Loves, Dishonesty, His Barbecue, and Greatest Nemesis, Scissors, in Colin Firth. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Scott of the Antarctic, an angry, disappointed little man. What is your favorite occupation? I have recently fallen in love with barbecuing. I love to undercook chicken and give my family worms. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I am unable to use scissors. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Telling me the menu is only accessible through the QR code. What is your greatest extravagance? Barbecue equipment, especially heat-resistant gloves. I'm wearing some as I type. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Honesty. I'm sometimes asked by people who've just seen one of my films, "Do you mind if I'm honest?" I do. On what occasion do you lie? When asked whether everything is all right with my meal. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Drinking a pint of London Pride while munching Twiglets and reading about Colin Firth having a critical and box office catastrophe. What is your greatest fear? The cat bowls, with the old cat food dried on like cement. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My cloud of powder gray hair. I look like Liberace or a cigarette. Which living person do you most despise? Anyone in private equity or tech or London traffic planning or who uses a leaf blower? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Watch out, and shall we open another bottle? What or who is the greatest love of your life? Scandawife, sociopathic children, cunty cats. What is your current state of mind? Deranged. Where would you like to live? In Maria's Abbey and the Sound of Music, the peace, the Mother Superior. What is your most marked characteristic? Thinly veiled fury. What do you most value in your friends? Failure, unhappiness. What are your favorite names? Our local dentist growing up was Mr. Fang, lovely man, though he liked to be naked under his smock. What is it that you most dislike? Leaf blowers, scented candles, drafts, backpacks, water bottles, stretch fabrics. How would you like to die? My wife has kindly agreed to sneak up behind me and shoot me in the back of the head. That's all for now. I'm Christy with this month's Vanity Fair.